I tell you, there are some weeks when I'm like, why did I think this would be a good idea to talk about? And now I'm stuck talking about it. So this is one of those weeks. This story is brutal. I want to share with you from Genesis. It's so culturally, I think, offensive to us that it really needs all the context it can get. So that's what I want to sort of start with, is provide as much context as I can. I want to do that by sharing with you the story of Marcus Luttrell, as told by him in his book Lone Survivor, which is such a fascinating story that's based on a U.S. mission in Afghanistan that goes really, really bad, really poorly. And what's fascinating about the book and Marcus's story is just how many bizarre ethical situations come about in this book. The story plays out this way. In June of 2005, Marcus Luttrell was the leader of a four-man American sniper team, and they were sent on a covert operation in Afghanistan called Red Wing. And the soldiers were dropped off into this very mountainous, remote region, and they were told to hike overnight several miles into an area where they were overlooking a village. And their task was to set up a camouflaged area, hide themselves there, and then wait for this notorious Taliban leader to show his head. And when he did, they're a sniper team. Take him out. And so that was the mission. Plan, just wait there. It could be days, could be weeks. Wait when you see this guy, take him out. Now, the plan fell apart rather quickly because what happened is two shepherds and their flock started making their way up the mountain right towards their sniper position. And they're hoping that they will go undetected, but this group of two shepherds stumbles literally right upon their sniper nest. And then they're in this real predicament. Because they know if they let these shepherds go, they have a very strong hunch they're going to march back down the mountain, tell the Taliban they're there, and then, well, there's trouble coming. And so there's an argument between the four-man team. Two of them say, let's just kill the shepherds, because if we don't kill them, our lives are in danger and our mission's going to be in big trouble. But Marcus Luttrell is the head of the team. He says, we can't do that. It would be unethical. So they let them go. Sure enough, their worst nightmare comes to fruition. They watch these two shepherds descend the mountain, and within hours, they're surrounded by the Taliban. And a crazy battle breaks out. And within the course of a few hours, all three of Marcus's fellow soldiers are dead. Marcus is also wounded, but he manages to flee into the mountains with the Taliban hot on his trail. And over the course of 36 hours, he flees throughout this remote mountain region until he's so overcome by his injuries, he collapses by a stream and lays there knowing his fate is now out of his hands. He will either be rescued, killed, or found, taken by the Taliban, and then, well, that's probably going to be trouble. So he passes out there thinking when he wakes up, trouble's coming. But that doesn't happen. Instead, he wakes up and finds himself in the hands of a man called Muhammad Ghulab. And he's the patriarch leader of an Afghani village in the region who stumbled upon him in the mountains. And Ghulab's village in Afghanistan belongs to the Pashtun tribe of people who historically have not seen themselves as friends of the West. In fact, they despise the notion of outside countries trying to impose Western social standards on them. So he wakes up to this man. He knows he's from the Pashtun tribe, and Luttrell believes his fate is now sealed. He's either going to be killed immediately on the spot or he's going to be handed over to the Taliban. But to his surprise, Ghulab takes Luttrell into his village. He nurses his wounds, and several days later, he helps the U.S. military evacuate him out. And in those days between him being taken into the village and being rescued, the Taliban figured out that Luttrell was in this village. And they surrounded the village and they demanded from Ghulab that they hand over Luttrell, but Muhammad Ghulab wouldn't do it. And with him saying no, the Taliban launched wave after wave of attack on this village. Kept saying, hand him over or we'll wipe your village out. Again, he wouldn't do it. Constantly demanded handing over Luttrell, but despite he lost some men in this battle, His wife and his children, Muhammad Ghulab's wife and children, were at constant risk and danger. He wouldn't hand over Luttrell. He protected him until the U.S. could evacuate him. It's a remarkably surprising and shocking story on many levels. Ghulab stumbles upon this man, injured stranger in the forest. He owes him nothing. In many ways, he's an enemy. He could have walked on by. He could have left him for dead. But he takes the stranger in, knowing he's from a nation he no ways considers a friend. But more than that, he takes him in and continues to protect this stranger while risking the lives of his family and village. Why? Why would a man do such a thing? The answer is that it comes down to an ancient Pashtun Wali code of conduct that every proud Pashtun follows. And a key component of this code is called Melmastia, or hospitality. And it follows this line of thinking. Offering hospitality to a stranger is so important, it must transcend race, religion, economic status. And it also means this. Once a guest is under your roof, a guest is not allowed to be harmed or surrendered to an enemy. In fact, the Melmastia Code insists that a host should be willing to sacrifice anything and everything, including family and safety, for the sake of a stranger or guest in your home. Hospitality is that important. It's a code of honor. It's a code of honor that saved Luttrell's life. And as we move into these stories of Genesis here, the next couple stories, I would like to suggest that this code of conduct is underneath everything we read. It is the guiding principle that's going on here in the next few chapters. Because we're given actually in the next few chapters, Genesis 18 and 19, two parallel stories. We're going to be shown the code of hospitality done right. And then we're going to be shown that code violated so egregiously, it can only be described as pure evil and malevolence. And so the adventure stories for Abraham continue in Genesis 18. It starts this way. The Lord appeared to Abraham near the great trees of Mamre. While he was sitting at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day, Abraham looked up and he saw three men standing nearby. And when he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. He said, "If I found favor in your eyes, do not pass your servant by. Let a little water be brought. I'll wash your feet. You can rest under this tree. I'll make you something to eat so you can be refreshed. Then you can go on your way. Now that you've come to your servant." He said, "Very well. Do as you say." So here we have Abraham at home. He's relaxing, doing his thing. Three mysterious men show up, and the story leaves their identity rather ambiguous. Are these angels? Is it God and some angels? Is this another Christophany? We don't know. And I think the ambiguity of the story is actually quite important, because when the stranger shows up, you don't know who you're dealing with. Are they friend or foe? Do they come in peace or conflict? You don't know. But Abraham demonstrates the heart of Melmastia here, of hospitality. Abraham, you could say, is a master of the stranger, and he demonstrates the heart of hospitality. And it's this. It's taking a particular attitude or posture towards the stranger. And that posture is this: welcome and trust. It's a posture, you could say, that begins by giving the stranger the benefit of the doubt. And I think this is important, because when you start with trust, I think you evoke the best from others. And so hospitality, this code of hospitality, it's an act of courage, right? Because every instinct, I would say, inside of us cries out to be afraid of the stranger. And I think we have plenty of experiences that tell us we should be wary of the stranger. I was tobogganing with the kids this winter. We're out on the hill. It was just us, me and the three kids, so the four of us there, and we're having a good time. We were back up at the top of the hill. I saw a man approaching over the way. Came over, he started talking to us. You ever get that sense, though, when somebody lingers too long? Like, all right, hello, hello, now this is getting awkward. And he sat down beside my kids, and how are you guys doing? And it just went on to the point of awkwardness. You enjoying your time out there, and I got this immediate sense, like, am I going to have to do something bad to this man, like he's hovering a little bit too much, and I got this eerie sense from him, and I started one-word answers. He would ask questions, yes, no, giving him the cold shoulder, like, get out of here, stranger, you're creeping me out. Finally, I think he picked up the hints, but he ended the conversation this way. He said, you know, I just moved to the area from Toronto, and I'm just thrilled by how many parks are in Kitchener. I love to see families out enjoying their time, and went on his way. I sort of sat there thinking to myself, my goodness, my immediate posture with strangers tends to be suspicion, almost hostility. Never trust a stranger. Somebody talks to my kids too long, I'm like, hey, creep. And it's bizarre to me because I feel like my starting posture is suspicion. We're taught to fear the stranger, and for good reason. I don't need to tell you stories of bad strangers doing bad things. And fear is a good thing. It's fundamental to keeping us safe and alive. Our fear of strangers, it protects us from threats. It's a needed guard. But I'd also say our suspicion of strangers also creates a world that is very guarded and paranoid. And I think the story, one of the first things it does here is it pushes us towards malmastia, hospitality, starting with the posture of welcome and trust. And even beyond that, beyond this idea of the stranger as a person, I think the story pushes us further to ask ourselves some questions. How do we treat the stranger or the strange? How do we treat strange ideas, strange people? How do we interact with the strange? You could put it this way. How do you interact with that which is not you or normal for you? And the story coaches us along here towards a better way of living that says, if you start with trust and welcome, it's a better sort of way to live life than always starting with hostility and suspicion towards the strange, the stranger. I don't know if you remember when Kijiji first started being. Such an amazing idea that you can just post things and trade things. And when it first came out, a friend was showing me this, and I didn't really have anything I wanted to sell or buy, but for some reason I had this inclination. I posted an ad on Kijiji saying I was looking for interesting ideas. So I just posted, looking for interesting ideas. Tell me your ideas. I'm looking for something interesting here. I didn't think I'd get a reply. I didn't for a while, but then somebody emailed me through this ad and said, hey, I've got a strange idea for you. I'd love to get together and talk to you about it. I want to talk to you about chemtrails. If you don't know what chemtrails are, it's this conspiracy theory. You know, the little white clouds that follow planes, this conspiracy theory that what's actually going on there is the government is spreading chemicals and biological components to, I don't know, whatever that does. And I got this email and I thought, well, there's a quack, I forget that. I never replied. And I thought, you know, it's interesting when we encounter strange ideas, like even flat earth stuff going on these days, people think the earth is flat, how often our initial response is hostility and suspicion right away. And it doesn't mean sort of accepting quack ideas, but whenever we run into something that's strange, our initial response is, ugh, just get away. Instead of a posture of welcome and trust. And you know, I think the reality is this in life. Life is going to thrust the strange or stranger at you at some point. Someone who is strange is going to show up in your life. Someone who is strange in terms of their ideas, their politics, their faith, their economic situation, whatever it is. The story poses a question. When the stranger comes and shows up, how are you going to respond? Suspicion, hostility, or welcome and trust? I think this is the lesson here from Abraham. It's a demonstration of malmastia. The world is a better place and is blessed when our initial posture is welcome and trust. And so we get that here, and it's like, well, that's a nice story. But then it takes a very peculiar twist. What happens is this. The Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great, their sin so grievous, that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I'll know. Well, this is interesting. We don't know what these cities have done, but apparently it's a cry has gone up. And this kind of language mirrors a passage we see in Genesis 4. In Genesis 4, the Lord speaking to Cain. The Lord said to Cain, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." And so there's this interesting idea in Scripture that injustice, blood, cruelty, murder, these things somehow cry out to God. And so this cry from the victims has reached God. And so these strangers in the story, they come to Abraham, and now they've headed off to investigate this cry, this accusation that's been heard by God. So they take off to investigate Sodom and Gomorrah, and then God and Abraham have a conversation, and I love this conversation. I feel like this is Abraham at his best, but this is what happens. The men turned away, they went towards Sodom, but Abraham remained standing before the Lord. Then the Abraham approached and said to God, "Will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in this city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50 righteous people in it? I mean, far be it for you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do right now?" Now, this is something. I like this. This is bold. "God, you're God, so you might want to act like God." The Lord said, "Fine. If I find 50 righteous people in the city of Sodom, I will spare the whole place for their sake." And Abraham spoke up again. "Now that I've been so bold as to speak to the Lord, though I'm nothing but dust and ashes, what if the number of righteous is 5 less than 50? Will you destroy the whole city for the lack of 5 people?" "If I find 45 there," God says, "I will not destroy it." Once again, he spoke to him. "What if only 40 are found there?" Now Abraham's getting a little bold here. God said, "For the sake of 40, I will not do it." Then he said, "Now, may the Lord not be angry, but let me speak. What if only 30 can be found there?" He answered, "I will do it. Will not do it if I find 30 there." Abraham said, "Now that I've been so bold as to speak to the Lord, what if only 20 can be found there?" He said, "For the sake of 20, I will not destroy it." Then he said, "May the Lord not be angry, but let me speak just once more. What if only 10 can be found there?" He answered, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it." When the Lord had finished speaking with Abraham, he left, and Abraham returned home. My goodness, I love this story. This is good. Bartering of it's like an art in science. I remember the first time I tried to barter was in Cuba. I heard that when you're walking around in the villages, you can barter. That's a thing, and it's a bit of a science how you do this. And I remember getting shot down so early. Chris and I had scouted out a painting we wanted to take home with us, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to barter. So I walked in. I'm like, this piece here, I'll give you $5 for it. And I said, no. I was like, but that's it? Like, I thought you bartered here. So I left the shop and went back to Kristen. I'm like, this bartering thing isn't going so well for me. And she's like, maybe you got to grease the wheels a little bit. So went back in, and he knew he had me at that point, and he just kept saying no. I was like, what about $10? No. And eventually he talked me right up to the price, which was just something like $100. And I think I got completely robbed for it that. But there's this interesting bartering as an art and science. And you can, this passage comes alive to me because you can almost sense Abraham, he's playing sneaky salesman here with God, right? Like, oh, I'll try my luck with 50, 45. And I love it. I love this scene because it's just so delightful to me. But I love that Abraham calls God on his own moral standard. God, if you're so righteous, I'm calling you to do the right thing here. And God's response is, fair enough. You tell me then what is the right thing to do. Save it for 50 people, 45, 40, 30, 20, gets them down to 10. And Abraham's, I think, kind of annoying about it, but it's a brilliant scene. It's a touching scene as well. Because, you know, I tend to think and look at the God of the Old Testament as a bit of a come across as a bit of a reckless, violent tyrant. But God's desire to show mercy, or at least to find balance between mercy and judgment, is pretty evident here. And as we'll see in a moment, this city is really forcing God's hand. Even still, apparently God can be bartered with, so there you go. So they reach a deal. The nature of God's deal with Abraham is intriguing to me on this level as well. What it seems to communicate is this: even when goodness and virtue are vastly in the minority, that good can keep a place from being destroyed. What this preaches is that good is always way more powerful than evil. And God's economy is radically different. And so we've got this deal between God and Abraham, and then it moves into the next part of the story. And when I started Nexus, I took a vow that I would never gloss over anything difficult, even though I really want to this morning. This passage is tough. So here's what happens. Two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. "My lords," he said, "please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet, spend the night, and then go on your way early in the morning." Again, the code of Melmastia in place here, code of conduct around hospitality. How do you engage with a stranger? Welcome and trust, or suspicion and hostility? Lot engages with trust and welcome. They answered, "No, we'll spend the night in the square." But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. So they're in his house, and the code of conduct is now at play. They've set foot in his house, and so now Lot is, by code of conduct, he must protect them at all costs. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." This is terrifying on so many levels. And the stories in Genesis, they play out so quickly, but you've got to imagine this mob mentality scene. Surrounded your house, banging on your doors. "We want these two men." And at this point, I can only think that Lot is thinking, "We're done. Like, everything is lost. We're at the mercy here of an angry, horny mob." And then this next part is brutal. Lot went outside to meet them, shut the door behind them. "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who've never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them. But don't do anything to these men, for they've come under the protection of my roof." I find that hard to even read. I really do. How do you even say something like that? And there's a cultural thing going on there. Even still, how you offer up your daughters to save someone else, I don't know. And Scripture never comments on this. It doesn't say he did the right thing, the wrong thing. But what it's painting for us is this absolute scene of desperation. It's a hopeless scene. It's a scene of life and death. Lot is bartering for the life of himself, his family. He's doing anything here. But that last line is telling. "Don't do anything, because they've come under the protection of my roof." You know the code. You know the code of hospitality. You know I cannot allow anything to happen to these men now that they're under the roof. So you know the code. So please stop. "Get out of our way," they reply. "Look, this fellow comes here as a foreigner, and now he wants to play the judge." Well, this line is telling. It's mocking of Lot. "You're going to invoke some kind of ethic with us? Some kind of moral? Are you suggesting, Lot, that there might be some sort of moral truths that apply to everyone? Please, there are none. We don't recognize any code of conduct, any morality, any appeal to a higher ethic beyond what we want for ourselves." Said to him, "We'll treat you worse than them." And they kept bringing pressure on Lot to move forward to break down the door. I was looking for art around this scene, and I came across this unfamiliar to me. It's called The Sodomites by James Tissot. And I found this piece of art to be absolutely fascinating, because particularly the two front trying to break in, I couldn't shake this idea that they looked to me like zombies. And I thought that was telling. That's exactly the scene we're given here. Something so wretched is going on here. It's like a zombie apocalypse. These people are almost not even human anymore. Their desire to feed off of other humans. It's almost like last week I talked about Genesis as a Game of Thrones story. This week it comes to me as like a Walking Dead episode. And this cruel, almost half-human people who just desire to feed off of others. They're trying to break in, and they've created this literal hell on earth. This is like a zombie apocalypse we're witnessing here. And, you know, unpacking this story is not easy because this is a brutal story. I mean, at its most simple, okay, they're violating the code of conduct around how you interact with strangers. Welcome, trust, hospitality, these codes have been abandoned. And it's not even just out of suspicion. This is outright hostility and evil and malevolence. They've strayed so far from the code, these people now see other humans as simply objects of rape, personal pleasure. And you know, I think there's a negative injunction here about hospitality and stranger will. If you cannot treat the stranger right just because that's the right thing to do, well, then you better treat them right because you don't know who you're messing with. And they're going to find out the hard way they're messing with the wrong people. And I realized, I was going through that this is basically the premise of every superhero movie in the world. I recently watched Logan, story of Wolverine and the X-Men. It's him in his later years. And the plot begins with this exact scenario. Logan is in his car. He looks homeless. And these thugs come and try to rob him of his car. And they clearly don't know who they're messing with, and they end up dead because they've messed with Wolverine, and so you don't do that. And so there's like this negative injunction in the story. Don't mess with strangers because, well, it's the right thing to do. You shouldn't do that, but don't mess with them because you never know who you're messing with. And you might find yourself in a whole host of trouble, and that's about to happen. But more than this stranger hospitality code, there's a certain sexual component to this story as well, and I think it has to do with this, the absolute danger of immediate gratification. And I think it highlights for us the incredible peril we find ourselves in as a culture when sexual activity finds itself outside the constraints of a civilized structure. And I don't care what you call that, but when that happens, it's hell. When this happens, you find yourself living in an absolute hell on earth. I think it's true then. I think it's true now. And this mob shows up and says, fork them over. We're going to do whatever we want with them. Whatever the hell we want to do with them, we're going to do. And it's not going to go well for you, Lot, if you try to get in the way. It's completely deregulated sexual behavior. Any sort of sexual norm has lost. It's been thrown out the window. And it's an indication to me of something deeper going on. The whole social structure has fallen apart here. This is an apocalypse. The only thing that's left for them to do is engage in the most brutal forms of immediate gratification. So the men inside, they reach out, they pull Lot back in the house to save him, they shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so they could not find the door. The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons or daughters, anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here because we're going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great, he has sent us to destroy it." And so for these men, the investigation's complete. It's done. They've come to investigate. They've made their verdict. This place has created a literal hell on earth. And God is not happy. And it's fire and brimstone time. And judgment is coming. And the outcry of God is so great. The outcry that has reached God is so great. He's bringing the fire and he's bringing the fury. And the story in Genesis it's tough to read. It offends our cultural sensibilities, but it dramatically illustrates what I think is a very important truth. God is not a neutral or casual observer of the world. God did not create the world and then walk away. God is not observing the world from a distance. The cries of victims and the oppressed, they reach God's ear. And the God who ultimately desires mercy, the God of infinite patience, is also the God of justice. And those ideas don't fit so well together. It's a tension we must hold. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were pledged to marry his daughters. And he said, "Hurry and get out of this place because the Lord is about to destroy this city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. With the coming of the dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife, your two daughters who are here, or you'll be swept away when the city is punished." When he hesitated, the men grasped his hands in the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them safely out of the city. For the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, "Flee for your lives. Don't look back. Don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you'll be swept away." By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, destroying all those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the lands.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time.
Sooner or later, God'll cut you down. Sooner or later, God'll cut you down.
Go and tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter.
Tell him the God's gonna cut him down. Tell him the God's gonna cut him down.
Goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me in a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, "John, go and do my will." I'm gonna tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter.
Tell him the God's gonna cut him down. Tell him the God's gonna cut him down.
You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time.
Sooner or later, God'll cut you down. Sooner or later, God'll cut you down.
You may throw your rock and hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. And sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go and tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter.
Tell him the God's gonna cut you down. Tell him the God's gonna cut you down. Tell him the God's gonna cut you down.
You know, it's only Johnny Cash that can kind of pull off a song like that. And this is actually an old spiritual song that Moby first sampled in the early 90s. And then Johnny Cash did a version of it. It made it incredibly popular. In fact, what's interesting to me is when a music video was made for this, it kind of cracks me up. All of Hollywood's A-list celebrities and musicians joined and decided to make a music video about this, about God's judgment. And it cracks me up. Because you've got all these sort of people who I would assume are quite skeptical of God, but seem to, because it's Johnny Cash, willing to sort of put together a song like this. And only Johnny can get away with this. And I love it, because this song with this story, it gives me pause. But pause is this. I have to confess, I have spent years dissecting and being disillusioned with the religious right. My disillusionment with progressive Christianity is growing rapidly these days. And if I have to wear a label, I would consider myself a progressive Christian who believes very firmly in a loving, radically inclusive, big-hearted, big-tent vision of Christianity. And I hold this: God is going to redeem the world. God is going to bring about the reconciliation of all things, all things. And yet there's a whole lot of evil and injustices in this world that are going to need to be dealt with. And to me, judgment seems like a necessary prerequisite for the reconciliation of all things. And I've said this in sermons before. I think the rage of God has to come before the restoration of all things. But the idea of judgment It, in my circles, it inevitably faces fierce resistance among so many people I know, and stories like this make us and me so uncomfortable. I do not like preaching, teaching about judgment. But what is odd to me is this. The resistance to the idea of judgment often comes from the people I know who are most, the most upset about evil, pain, and suffering in our world. And I can't understand why the people most moved by the injustices in this world are oftentimes the ones most queasy about the concept of judgment. And it seems strange to me. Why isn't God allowed to meet our rage? And you know, I think we're living in a time of a lot of cultural anger and appropriate anger. I think the Me Too movement has showcased for us the absolute failure of our culture and legal system to take sexual assault and sexual harassment seriously. And there's a lot of angry people about that, as they should be. Why is God not allowed to meet our rage? Just this week alone, there's been a lot of anger on social media that I've seen around indigenous peoples and the lack of justice, the absolute failure again of our moral, cultural, legal system to take indigenous injustices seriously. And there's a lot of people angry about that, as they should be. Why is God not allowed to meet our rage? And I feel like this, for a lot of us, we've lost something along the way, because in our hurry to pronounce love wins, we've left out God's going to cut you down. And I really think we need both of those together. Because if you only endorse one half of the equation, something vital is lost along the way. So again, I firmly believe this. What makes the Christian path so compelling to me is the promise that God's going to redeem and reconcile everything. God will write straight with crooked lines. And all the tears and pain and hurt, it will be redeemed. All things broken will be made new. All things will be reconciled through Christ. And in this story, we see God desperate to show mercy. But stories like these in Genesis, they're not just passing curiosities for us to either ignore or scorn. And you know what? It's so easy for us to say, well, did this literally happen? Let's have an argument about whether it literally happened. And to me, that's an exercise in missing a point. And it's also a great way to avoid the inherent warning of the story. Who cares if it's literal? What's the warning? The warning is this: what we do matters. All of us, the decisions we make, they matter, and they have consequences. And some of our actions today, they might not end up with consequences in our justice system, flawed as they are, but that's not the final word. What we do matters. And if we personally or as a culture insist on brazenly manipulating people, hoarding power over people, exploiting and abusing and arrogantly hurting people in the name of our own pleasure, in the name of our own safety, if we insist on disregarding virtue, ignoring morality, seeing people as objects, pretending sex doesn't need structure or protections or boundaries, if we keep using power to get what we want, making our gratification the most important thing, if we insist on playing the game of life by our own rules, sooner or later God's going to cut us down. And I think we need to hear that. And I hate saying it, but I hold firmly to this reconciliation of all things. I truly do, but that does not exclude judgment. And this story is a warning and an invitation. There's another way to live life. You can run on doing your thing for a long time, but if you play that game for too long, sooner or later, you're going to get cut down. Maybe not in this life, maybe not with our justice system, but it's not a good thing to trifle with God. And there's another way to live. It's to live life with God as quest. To see the other as sacred. Even the stranger, the strange. See them with eyes and hearts of trust and welcome. And so, these chapters give us a highly dramatic account of two ways to live. Which way is it going to be? One way leads to blessing. The other leads to judgment. May we choose wisely.